This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And boy, oh boy, do I have two good books for you today. You know, I usually don't do this back-to-back thrillers, but we all need thrillers right now. We all need something to take our minds off of. What's going on in the world? And so at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to be talking to Jeffrey Wilson and Brian Andrews about their new Tier 1 book. And I'm very excited about it. It's called Collateral. But right now, I am turning to a guest that I have been looking forward to talking to him because whenever I go to Outback Steakhouse, I think of him. Brad Parks, hi, how are you?
Well, with that introduction, how could I be bad? That Outback Steakhouse and the Bloomin' Onion, that you associate that with me, I can be nothing but thrilled with that.
I mean, they
that
really...
A new career highlight for me.
They should name a drink after you there. They should have it on the menu. You have to talk to them about that because that's it. I love to go there, and I love, well, you know, when they're open again. I think they're sort of open, but it's sort of depressing to have like four people in the whole restaurant. But yes, because you write books that are, let's just put it this way, they reveal one sort of layer after another, and I also think of you as the one who always, has a motto that disaster is always closer than you know.
That is correct.
And boy, oh boy, you managed to get us into a really exciting book again. Wow, as you know, that last time when we were talking, I was so thrilled with your writing in general because I love the way that you write. And that was a book where you were writing from a woman's perspective. And
right.
So it's exciting that you are back at it again. And this book is called, the new book is called Interference.
Yes, Interference. And once again, yes, writing as a woman, although I swear I took a book where I was writing as a man.
Yes.
For most of the book. I'm not strictly writing as a woman, although I was really, really pleased by a review I got the other day that said throughout most of this book, I thought that the author was Ms. Parks, and I only realized at the end that the person writing was a man, so he must have done the writing as a woman thing fairly well.
Yeah.
And that's like the highest praise you can get, right? Because it's a tricky thing. So actually, I know you know you have a lot of writers who listen to this show and people who kind of like the inside baseball aspect of writing, as it were. I actually began writing Bridget Bronick, the protagonist of this book, in third person. I wrote an entire draft of this novel where I was third person because I didn't want to necessarily be writing a woman again, right? I didn't want to, or at least not in that close first person way that you do when you decide to use the first person. And Patsy, I got to the end of the book, and the character just hadn't come alive for me. So, and if that's the case, I know she's not going to come alive for you. So I went back and rewrote her entire, every single section that involved Bridget Bronick. I rewrote it in the first person. And that was finally when she really came to life, and I felt like, oh, okay, I finally get it. I know who this character is now. And that involved having to write a woman in first person again. So here I am, pretending to be a woman once again.
Well, it works. Although, I'm not going to – there's one little thing that I wasn't –
uh-oh.
But I'm not going to say it, although – Let's just put it this way. I always believe that when you are, and especially you, because your books are very visual, very visual. When I was reading Closer Than You Know, I mean, I could so see, you know, Melanie Barrick.
Right. Very good.
It was so good. And then and the lawyer Honeywell, and I mean, they were so visual. So that's something we should always keep in mind when we are writing, that who is going to play who in the movie. So, you know, but you do get into her head, and I like the way the story is told, and her sections. I enjoy that. But you know, again, it's always a problem with you that you don't want to give away too much. So what's your little spiel without giving away? You know, I'm sure you have what your set thing that you want to say, but don't reveal what's going to happen.
Okay, I'll be very gentle.
Yes.
And it goes like this. So Bridget Bronick is a librarian. She has hearing loss. I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little bit. Her husband is a physicist who has been toying with the mysteries of the quantum universe and falling very ill because of it, and they don't understand why. And then suddenly her husband is kidnapped, and Bridget comes to realize that the only way to save him might be to harness the same quantum physics that has been making him sick all along.
Uh-huh.
Is that good? I didn't give away too much.
You didn't give away too much because, well, first of all, I knew I was going to enjoy it because I love physics. That was my favorite. Well, I had two favorite classes in high school: Latin, which I loved, and physics, which mostly because I loved the teacher. He was so gorgeous.
Well, right. The right teacher can make any subject
work.
Yeah,
he was the only good-looking guy teacher in the whole school. He had been a pilot in Vietnam, and you know, he had that pilot swagger kind of thing. He was no longer a pilot. You know, he had been shot down, I think, a couple of times, but he still had it. You know, that look.
Right. Sure.
And so I loved physics. I mean, there were only two girls in the physics department, and at the time, you know, it's still. I mean, I'm glad they're working on that STEM thing because, but it was fun, and I love that class. I loved it. So when the minute I saw this, we're gonna get into physics and then quantum physics. Oh my goodness!
Right. Although, if I may take a moment of pride here, I've heard from a number of people that, you know, they said they were a little afraid of the physics part before they got into the book, but that I kept the physics very relatable and very approachable.
It is. It's very approachable.
And that was something I worked very hard on. And well, I should say, it was a priority for me to keep it approachable. It wasn't actually that hard work because it turns out, Patsy, I was not a great physics student. So for me, remembering how to explain physics to people who are not great physics students comes very naturally, because then I'm just explaining it to myself. But yeah, I love the physics in this book. So the principle that all of this is based on is called quantum entanglement, which is, believe it or not, it's a real thing. It is this notion that every once in a while, two particles can be born entangled. And when that happens, you can separate them by any distance whatsoever. You tickle one, and the other immediately feels it. They have this kind of intrinsic connection to each other that is instantaneous and can exist across galaxies, right? Now, it's a crazy, crazy concept. As a matter of fact, Einstein, who was the first person to kind of realize that the equations of quantum physics would predict this would be so, thought that this was a sign that quantum physics was broken, right? Because this was so insane that two particles could have this connection to each other that happened, by the way, faster than the speed of light, right? Because this is instantaneous. And Einstein thought the speed of light was as fast as anything could move in the universe. But, well, it turns out in subsequent years, we have been able to prove, beyond the shadow of any doubt, experimentally, that entanglement actually exists. Right, you really can have these entangled particles that, and we've proven it. The Chinese have actually launched a satellite into space, and they have demonstrated entanglement happening over 1,100 kilometers or something like that. So the question at the center of Interference, this novel, is: all right, so if you can have particles get entangled with one another, what about having human beings entangled with one another? And haven't you ever felt that you had some kind of intrinsic connection to another person, whether it's, you know, people talk about twin sense, or people talk about, you know, a spouse or a best friend that they've been connected with for a long, long time, and something bad happens to them and they just know it. They have the sense of foreboding, right? And so could that, in fact, be a real thing and be based in physics? And that is the concept we toy with in interference.
And toy with it you do. It is good. It is really good. Whoa. You know, I believe there's this metaphysical entanglement that happens
right.
with people. I really do. And so the whole story as it unrolls and, you know, we meet the different characters throughout, it's just a good read. And one of the things is, you know, of course, I always love when a book is, you know, set in a real place, like, you know, Dartmouth, and I wonder if do they why are you using why do they
well,
like
I'm,
it?
I'm an alum of Dartmouth, right?
So you can get away with it.
I have some ownership of it. I can do bad things to my own alma mater.
I'm somehow
allowed to do that.
Yeah,
this was, you know, frankly, Patsy, it was just straight up laziness, because I realized I wanted to tell this story of a university professor, and well, what university do I know better than my own, right? So this was just a nice opportunity to be able to write a setting that I didn't have to do a lot of extra research on, because I had already done 4 years worth of very exhaustive and very fun research, I might add. So that's why we set the book at Dartmouth College.
Yeah, well, I liked it. I thought, oh, I'm sure. And I, of course, I figured out right away. I couldn't remember for sure if that's where you went, so I had to go back and check. But I think, they'll let him get away with it.
Because, right.
You know, as a matter of fact, now I'm thinking about it. If they're working on in one of their English classes, they do teach English and writings,
oh,
I
sure.
guess. Yeah.
Oh, lots of English.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do hope that they use Closer Than You Know as an example of really the way you brought in those characters and brought that story. I think it's one that students should study. It's really great. And so the new one, of course, I like the, tell us a little bit about how you came out with Sean Plotner. And that's a nice plot.
Isn't that a great name, Sean Plotner?
Yeah.
So, okay, honest engine time, Patsy. You know, I was kind of going back through. I was feeling my Dartmouth as I was imagining this, and believe it or not, so Sean Plotner. You know, all of my characters are always a grab bag, right? They're a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit. But the root of Sean Plotner, the shadowy billionaire at the heart of the plot of Interference, is this guy my wife dated right before she dated me. So my wife and I met in college. We are now happily married, everything like that. I think he was pretty much the last guy she dated before me, was this guy who, it was so obnoxious, he never went to class, and then he always got straight A's. I mean, is that a guy you hate or what? And of course, he actually in real life grew up to work for a hedge fund. The last I saw, he was making something like $50 million a year.
Oh, well.
So if your wife's ex-boyfriend, who is now making $50 million a year, is not a character you can kind of get into digging at and hating a little bit, I don't know who you could, right? So the kind of the easy way that Sean Plotner is able to assimilate knowledge and then use it for his purposes and whatnot. And he was a fun character for me to play with and explore. I don't want to ruin anything for somebody who hasn't read it
yet.
But in 2020, somehow having a shadowy billionaire manipulating things on the side seems like a very real aspect of a novel.
Oh, it does. That really gave it. I thought that really set the tone right away. Yep, man, it's possible. This is, we have a few who are like getting the. Their worth is so astronomical, above most countries, that you can't even,
right.
You know, like, what do they think about? What do, you know? So, yeah, I thought it was great. And I loved it. It was funny, too, as I'm reading it, and you wrote there about he's cutting onions and he's thinking of Fibonacci. That's when I thinking, yeah, whatever, anything to do with Brad Parks, I'm thinking of onions.
Fair enough. So, yes, that is for your readers. So, Bridget's husband, Matt Bronick, who's a physics professor, is another kind of fun character for me because he's, I love the idea of people coming from unconventional backgrounds and arriving at a certain place. So, in the case of Matt Bronick, he is this southern boy who comes from this little hog town in North Carolina, Clinton, North Carolina, where basically everybody who isn't a hog farmer is working at the hog processing plant, right? Mm-hmm. And to have that kind of place be a place that could meant genius and brilliance somehow. And so we had young Matt Bronick, who grew up in a diner that his parents ran that fed all of these hungry farmers and hungry hog processors. And yes, there's a line about how he was so gifted at math that even as he was working in the diner, every time he cut an onion, he was seeing Fibonacci sequences.
Yeah.
But I just I loved it, and I actually, again, you steal this stuff from real life, and I do have a buddy who grew up in a hog town, and the joke he always told me that I totally ripped off and used in the book was that his elementary school was right down wind from the hog processing plant, and on really hot days they would actually have to shut down the elementary school because the smell from the hog processing plant was so overpowering, and the local farmers always said that it smelled like money, but my buddy always insisted no, it smelled like dead pigs.
Yeah, it's very descriptive. That's when I read that, I said, yep, I like this story. You know, you, as always, you just do a great job, and I think that you know, during this time, are you finding, like, are you getting stressed out? I'm starting to get stressed out. I was okay, you know.
Starting to get stressed out, Patsy.
Starting.
You must be the toughest woman alive if you're only starting.
Yeah,
my
no,
Lord.
I'm only starting.
But, no, I mean, you know, when this all first hit, I mean, I definitely had some days where, boy, I just felt this just dreck all the time, and I would go to my wife and I would moan. I'd be like, honey, I don't understand why this is all so hard. You know, all I'm doing is just hanging out in the house in my pajamas. Well, why is that so difficult? And she said, honey, you're an extrovert in the middle of a pandemic. Why do you think this is hard? So I think I've come to realize that, but then I'm also kind of forever cognizant, Patsy, that early on during the outbreak, the New York Times ran this handy chart of how dangerous is your job, right? And they put on one axis, you know, how often you had to come in contact with people, and then on the other axis they put the closeness of that contact. And you know, so the doctors and the nurses and the first responders, the real heroes of this pandemic.
Are you kidding? The people who do the bagging at the
yeah, right. You know, like, you know, they are in the far upper right corner of the chart.
They
you
are
know,
the
most dangerous jobs. Authors were down in the lower left corner. We were next to lumberjacks as having the safest possible job. So as much as, you know, yes, of course it's been hard, and, you know, having my kids, you know, right outside the door as I'm trying to write, you know, has been, oh, it's been a joy, Patsy, for sure. But then I'm also mindful of, you know, I still got it better than most.
Oh, you do. And I tell you, your wife is very lucky. I think she got the right guy. Who needs $50 million a year when she has someone like you who can tell a great story, and you're fun and you're charming, and she must, I think she must have a hoot with you. So I think she got the best of the deal. That's my opinion.
Well, you'll have to have her on the show sometime and ask her, Patsy. Well, but you know, maybe you'll get a different answer depending on the day, right?
Well, again, you know, I just want to thank you so much for being on today, because I'm like, I have after you, and I don't normally do this. And this I want to tell you, and I'm going to tell them too. I do not normally have a thriller and then a thriller on the same program. So I normally would have after you, I would have a cookbook or a romance or you know, one of those something like that, because I want people to concentrate on the thriller. But right now we need thrillers. I cannot take another. I can't take sort of an angsty kind of book right now. I need this kind of book. This book, you get into, and you want to know what's happening. And I really do love how it is told, you know, through the wife, and so you can see what's happening through her eyes. You did a great job, and as always, you know, you get this woman's perspective so beautifully. And again, you know, Brad Parks, I think you are wonderful. What's your website? Where do you want people to find you?
So it is www.bradparksbooks.com, or they can find me on Facebook at Facebook/Brad Parks Books, or they can find me on Twitter at Brad_Parks. And Patsy, it is always just so much fun to have on. And I think you've nailed the exact spirit of what the thriller is and should be, and that's escapism,
exactly.
Right? It is something that really takes us away from our troubles, and Lord knows we have a lot of troubles right now that we need to be taken away from. And so if me and my fellow thriller writing brethren and sistren can provide that escape and provide that distraction, well, then I think we're doing our job.
Well, you certainly did with Interference. And then when you finish that, go and read Closer Than You Know. And all you college professors out there teaching writing courses, I think you should use that book too. And again, thank you so much. It's always a joy. And I need to have you back because I wanted to do a half-hour program just about the Carter Ross books. Okay?
Well, Patsy, I'm available anytime. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Okay. Brad Parks, what a guy. What? Oh, he's so funny. I think he's cute. Oh, now, and I'm going straight now to two really, really cute guys. And unfortunately, I do not have, you know, it's just, what can I say? I just love thrillers. I need a thrill. And so I'm just so excited that, again, are we on? Huh? No, I'm not going to do a break. I'm just going to go straight into this interview because I can't wait. And I'll do the commercials after. Okay. Hey, guys. Are you on?
Patsy.
Okay. Do I have Jeffrey Wilson and Brian Andrews on?
Jeffrey. Brian, are you there?
Okay. I've got Jeff. Okay. Well, Jeff, I'll start with you. Okay. Wow, because I'm waiting for your partner, because you know, I always think of you two as sort of the Lucy and Ethel, the Lucy and Ethel of the writing world.
Yeah, well, we can't write a book without each other. How can we possibly do an interview, right?
That's right. You have to get always together. And, well, so now I've got Brian, so we've got Jeffrey Wilson and Brian Andrews. And do people go crazy and sometimes call you Jeffrey Andrews and Brian Wilson because you're so interchangeable?
Only
we are interchangeable.
Well, I like to think of you as Lucy and Ethel. And so here you are back because you were here the day after Veterans Day last year, 2019. And can you believe it's 2020? And we were talking about book 5. And now we are on to book 6. My goodness gracious, Collateral. Wow. It's exciting, huh?
Oh, it's always fun when a new one comes out, right? And this one, I got to tell you, we're always excited for John Dempsey and his crew. But this one has us particularly excited because we as writers sort of pushed ourselves on this one. We raised the stakes to global stakes. And we really, for the first time, incorporated a lot of big, overt military stuff. We have an Arleigh Burke destroyer in this one. We have Marine F-35s. We have Air Force flying the F-22s. We have Marines on the ground and superpowers colliding. So it's something new for us that we're really excited to share with the readers, and we hope they enjoy reading it, because we sure enjoyed writing it, I can tell you.
Well, I'm sure they will, because, you know, after you left us at the last one, you know, your Ember operators had faced some devastation, but you come back strong now, and the wonderful thing is you have such wonderful characters that we just love, from Dempsey to Munn to Grimes to Wang and Baldwin, and of course, you are always right there writing absolutely such wonderful, strong women in the story, too.
Thank you very much. So that is one of the greatest compliments, is that when our characters resonate with readers, then that means we did our job.
And tell us about, in this book, you have some different points of view. Some of the characters have... Explain how you put this together.
Well, all of our books are done in multi-POV, which is common in thrillers, of course, because it allows the reader to see things from different perspectives, to gain information that maybe even your main protagonists don't have. And so not only do we tend to give POV to several of our protagonists, but we oftentimes will give an antagonist POV as well in the Tier 1 series, and we've done that here. So it allows the reader to get inside the mind of the bad guy, so it's not just a cartoon character, you know what I mean? You know, guy stroking a cat in a strange room, like is from the old days. So we have motivations for our antagonists. They have their own lives and their own relationships, and I think it just makes it a little deeper and broader for the reader.
Well, tell us the basic outline of the story, because we are now, as I said, Task Force Ember is, well, we're facing a potential World War III in this book.
We really, like Jeff said, we really wanted to up the stakes in this book, and I think we might have talked to you about this before, but, you know, we do something a little differently in that our series is back-to-back trilogy. So the first three books were what we call our VVAC, or our Persian trilogy, which really focused on the Middle East and the threat from Iran. And then this set of three books, starting with American Operator, is our Russia trilogy. So in each of the books of the trilogy, the stakes go up. And like you said, Patsy, in the previous book, Red Spectre, and sorry for any of the listeners who might be new to our series, you might want to hum out loud or cover your ears for this part, but there was some devastation and loss for the Ember Task Force as their doppelganger, you know, enemy task force on the Russia side, the Zeta Task Force, struck back. So this one is really about Ember trying to pull itself back together up by the bootstraps and go after this this threat. But in the process, what they find out is that our friends over there in Russia have designs on further destabilizing Ukraine and really taking control of the Black Sea. And that area of the world over there can be quite a powder keg. So that's what we wanted to play around with, is wargaming out, you know, what would happen if Russia did start getting designs on reclaiming their old Nova Russia territories from, you know, 200 years ago.
Well, can you believe it? It's 2020 and we're still involved with the Ukraine, for goodness sakes. Poor Franz Joseph in 1853, he had to deal with all those countries and he thought it was, you know, he was so optimistic and he thought that he could, you know, make everything peaceful over there. And it's like, my gosh, we're 150 years, 180 years later, we're still dealing with this thing.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, that area of the world has been fraught with conflict for thousands of years, right? If you look at the broad region, and not much promise that that's ever going to stop. But as a thriller writer, it's a great opportunity for us. This is a different type of conflict, though, isn't it? You know, with all that's been going on in Russia over the last few years, it made for a really exciting opportunity for us, because I think that what you see in this novel, and actually this and the two before it, in this new trilogy, sort of what we're referring privately to as our Russian trilogy, is you're seeing something that mirrors what's going on in our military, and that is a real pivot towards a different kind of threat. So, you know, we now have been at war in the Middle East with Islamic terrorism for coming up on 20 years. And that means there are people that went into the military or were very junior in the military who are approaching retirement, who have never really faced a threat other than that. And so what we asked ourselves as we set off in these books, beginning with American Operator, is, you know, what if the Russians were the puppet masters here? What if they were the ones pulling the strings? And over a series of books, it all came to a head between America and Russia. Wow, wouldn't that be something? Because you're talking about covert operators who have been in the mountains of Afghanistan and the deserts of Iraq, facing a very different enemy. What if all of a sudden their enemy has satellites and drones and fighter jets and destroyers like we do? How will we adapt? How will our military force adapt to that threat, that historic threat that they have not personally faced before? And so that was sort of the situation we wanted to put our heroes in, was having to rely on their training and somewhat their experience, but to adapt to a very, very new, much larger, much more capable threat. And that was really, really fun to write.
Well, you have, as you said, you brought out some big equipment here this time. Tell us about some of the research that went into this. What did you pick and why? You know, because these Russians are going around buzzing us. For goodness sakes, I don't like that. I don't like what they're doing. I'm telling you, my husband was a pilot, you know, and so we were, anything to do with flying was always, you know, it's something that we always gravitate to, and I got so mad when I saw what the Russians did the other day.
Yeah, you're talking about them sort of flexing their muscles up near Alaska, where they send the bombers over and they surf. They're doing war games up there.
Well,
they surface.
I don't know. My instinct would be to blow them out of the sky. So I'm not. I don't know. I'm sort of a little bit rough here.
Yeah, a little rough. Well, I mean, I think that what you've got, but you're really capturing the sentiment, I think, though, of the frustration that, you know, for example, in the Black Sea, this is recognized as international body of water. It's a captive body of water, and access into and out of the Black Sea is controlled by Turkey. But, you know, navigating should be, you know, open seas, freedom of navigation in the Black Sea. And what you see is that Russia has really looked at the Black Sea as, you know, this is ours. We should own and control the whole thing. And so they're very, very aggressive about posturing like you said, they send those SU-24s and 27s to buzz whatever ship that we send in there. So what we decided to do is, let's just take a page out of reality. And we actually picked the Donald Cook, an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, to be the ship that we wanted to have go into the Black Sea, because the Donald Cook has gone into the Black Sea and has actually faced off against the Russians on multiple occasions. So we thought we'd pay tribute to that ship and the courage of their sailors and steadfast operating of their captains. And so that's why the Donald Cook is featured in this book as an asset going into the Black Sea to have to stand against Russian posturing and aggression, and they have to face off against the exact types of things that they do in real life. And it was really fun for us to bring in that surface Navy element and into the story. That's something new. So we have a new point of view character, Commander Dustin Townsend, who's the captain of that boat.
Well, that's, you know, that I always, you know, sometimes people will say, don't get too technical. For me, I love the technical part. I mean, that's why, you know, Tom Clancy was so much fun. There was so much detail. And I love to know about weapons, about ships, about airplanes. I think it makes the story, well, partly we want to escape from our reality. And it's better to be in the book, because if I was really doing the web, I'd probably blow somebody up. I have no patience with anything anymore. I'm thinking if I was a pilot, I don't know, you know, really pilots have to have real good control of themselves, because if some SOB came so close to me, I don't know if I could be so nice about it.
So I agree with you. I think most readers, or at least in our genre, the readers that we have, they do like to learn, but they don't like to be taught. And so as a writer, there is a real balance. And what I mean by that is they love to have read the book and been caught up in the action and come away with some new knowledge. But if they feel like you're teaching them, if they feel like you're over-describing or going into such detail that it, you know, sort of slows down the story or the plot, then they don't like it. And it, I can tell you that as a writer for Brian and I, it's a balancing act that we go back and forth on quite a bit. You need to find context where you can share, you know, some of the technical things. There's a lot of stuff in here about the Arleigh Burke. There's some things about some of the missile systems. There's some things about the capabilities of some of these fighter jets. And that of our protagonists, you know, the Kilos that are maybe in the area hunting the Arleigh Burke and the threat they represent. So we want to bring that out, but we don't want it to be a technical manual where it just like kills the page.
Yeah, no,
so
you blend it in. You blend it in so beautifully right into the story. And of course, the nice thing is we know that you know that if you yourself. You might not have your own personal experience with a weapon. We know that you know enough people who do so that you're getting the right thing. You're not just picking it up from Wikipedia.
Yeah, we get to cheat a little bit, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, right? Because you know the right people. I have a feeling that a lot of the right people come to you and you can sit around. Well, I don't know if you can't sit around in a bar anymore, but wherever we can sit around nowadays. But you have the people who can give you this. That's why I think when you write about technical things, it really does take us into the story. And as I said, it makes us feel good. I mean, we do like to learn. We like to come out, as you said, knowing something more, a little bit more. And then when we read the newspapers, it's like, oh, yeah, I know about that.
So absolutely, and we want the reader to feel like what it would feel like to be on, for example, the Donald Cook trapped in the middle of the Black Sea, where you've got 8 Russian Kilo diesel submarines lurking around beneath you, and you've got these fast guided missile frigates the Russians, you know, send out to escort you around, and their fighter planes overhead. I mean, it really feels like you're backed in the corner. When you're a sailor on this ship, you can really feel the tension that the commanding officer would feel and the crew would feel, like you're just one second away from ending up on the bottom of the ocean.
Well, you have succeeded with this book because it's really, really good. And it, you know, Collateral, what a great name, because it is like so much going on every which way. And, you know, so you guys, we know how you write. As you've mentioned before, you actually don't know where one starts and the other lets off, because it's just, you work so beautifully together.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, that does sound like something you just say in an interview, but it really is true. I can tell you there's been a number of times where my wife will sit down with a book after it's come out, and because I don't let her read them before anymore because she's too much of an editor. And, you know, you write that beautiful paragraph and you want her to tell you how amazing it is, and instead she says, well, that's a run-on sentence and you need a comma. But when she reads the book when it's done, she'll sometimes come and say, oh, you know, this chapter or this part of this chapter, that was you, right? And I'll tell her the same thing I tell you guys. I don't know. By the time it's done, it's really just something that Brian and I worked hard as true co-authors to create. There's no dominant person for one aspect or another. We just work on these things together. We pass it back and forth. Obviously, one of us does the initial write on particular chapters, but by the time it's over and we've gone through it a few times, I really generally don't remember who did what. And that's kind of cool. And I think that's one of the reasons we've been able to, you know, sort of capture that single voice, because we spend so much time swapping things back and forth to make it that way.
Well, I remember in the last book, as I was reading, and I said at the time that I think one of the best scenes I've ever read in a thriller is that hospital scene that you wrote, which was just, it is really a scene that has to be studied because it goes page after page in a hospital, and I was literally holding my breath, and at one point I said, I have to breathe, because I know you guys must have had fun just writing that, how you did it, that it works so beautifully. It is really something to be studied.
Oh, that is a great compliment, and, you know, it's really fun to hear that, too, because when, you know, we know how these scenes are going to turn out. So as we write them, we don't get that experience of, oh, what's going to happen next, because we know. So that as fans of the genre and readers ourselves, we know exactly what you're talking about from reading our fellow, you know, our peers' books. And that is a really wonderful feeling when you're, like, you know, really nervous and not sure, and you actually think that something really bad could happen to the hero. And I think, you know, one of the ways that you do that is from time to time something bad does happen to the hero or his team. And, you know, that's your suspense in that scene was amplified by the fact that you had already seen something bad happen, I think, earlier in the book.
Well, you did a great job with Collateral, and I know that you are now working on something new, because you've now taken you've taken Chunk Redmond, who is a character, one of the secondary characters in the Tier One, and now you are working on a book for him.
Yeah, we're super excited about this new series that's coming out next year from Blackstone. So, you know, we always had a vision. You've read all the books, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. We always had a vision that from the very beginning in book one, when our fictional Tier One SEAL team is completely wiped out, that at some point in the real world, that unit would need to be stood back up. And so we always had in our mind that that would somehow fold into the, you know, the Tier One universe that we've created here. But when we got so much fan mail about Chunk Redmond, when we introduced him in War Shadows, and then he's made appearances in several books since, and eventually he had his team of SEALs with him, et cetera, people just really liked that character. And so Brian and I had a conversation about, you know, the best way to sort of kill two birds with one stone would be to stand up this new Tier One SEAL team with Chunk Redmond at the helm. And we were just very blessed that Rick Blaweis over at Blackstone liked the idea and was willing to embrace, you know, taking that series on. So June of next year, the first book in the series, Sons of Valor, will come out from Blackstone. In fact, it's a little early, but I think it's actually even available for pre-order now. So that first book in the series is written and in edits now. And boy, what a fun rush that was to go back to sort of our roots of just writing good Tier One SEAL team action, like you probably remember from the first Tier One.
Oh, I do. So. I do, because I probably wrote one of those fan letters. I want more Chunk. Because really, it's going, I know it's going to be great. And now we're saying June. Now, you know, last time you were here, Jeff, you were here, it was November, right after Veterans Day. You were here in the studio. And Brian, you were on the phone. But I hope that next June, Brian, you come down, and you have to come to Florida, and you have to come and visit to Florida. You need to come down once in a while here and get together, and you both have to come in the studio for the release of this new book. How about that?
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
Really?
Thanks for the invitation, and I love visiting Florida. It's a wonderful state, and I usually end up hanging out with Jeff the whole time. We're like, we never get any work done because we're just goofing off the whole time, but I love coming down there.
Okay, well, that's what you should do. You should plan to come down for the release date and then come on the program, and we can talk about it because, as I said, for your fans, they get very invested in your books. And one of your fans, I mentioned her last time, was Rita Moreau, and she's done that book buzz for you, and she's going to do another one where she does a little promo for you because she knows your characters. And I think it's partly because I think for women who love the books, it's funny that these are action books, and people would say, oh, well, you know, they're for men, but they're not, because you have strong women, you know, like Grimes and Petron. We feel like we're in those books too, and you know, kicking some butt. Can we say that on the radio? Are we allowed to say that? Anyway, we feel real good about it.
Well, we want to make these books approachable to everybody, you know, and we've been very intentional with Elizabeth and with Petra in the Tier One books, and I think that the people that have enjoyed those characters are going to be pretty excited with all of these books. As you know, and we'll maybe have a minute to talk about this later, we actually have four series we're going to be writing now moving forward, because we've got these two new ones that we haven't talked about yet. But all of them have strong female characters without exception. So in Sons of Valor, you're going to meet Whitney Watts, who is a CIA analyst, and she starts out as a fish out of water, much like Elizabeth Grimes did, but grows into a very powerful role within the new Tier 1 SEAL team. So we are going to keep that thread going in all of the series we write, including the Shepherds and the new thing we have going on with the Webb Griffin estate. So we're committed to keeping those characters up and real, because that's real life. You know, as you know, I served with a special warfare unit, and we have, while there are no women SEALs, there are women in the community that do incredible work, and we want our books to reflect that reality.
And they do. And also, your wives would probably hit you over the head if you wrote weak,
right.
Weak women who are so scared of everything, they can't do anything. And so that's great. That's great. I think I get the kicks from both sides. I love the strong women. And then I love, as I said, I love the military. Anything to do with military, anything to do, well, you know, you guys are, I don't know, I didn't introduce you as all the heroic things you've done and all of your career. People really, my listeners, we talk about you sometimes. I talk about that when I meet with writers. I talk about the hospital scene, because I say, you know, if you want really great writing, you have to look at that. Just briefly, we have a few minutes, give your backgrounds, because, you know, you can do it faster than I can.
Jeff, why don't you go first?
Yeah, Jeff.
Okay, so my background is a little bit eclectic, I suppose. I've done a number of things, which is why, you know, I'm a fiction writer, because my bio sounds like fiction. But I started out in aviation and was going to be a fighter pilot, got in a motorcycle accident, and that didn't work out for me. Wound up flying civilian for a while. And then worked for another branch of the government, of the federal government, for a short period of time. And I left that to sort of pursue a life of peace. So I wanted to do something else after the violence that I experienced there. And so I went to medical school and became a vascular surgeon. While I was still in training, I was a naval reservist because I decided to stay in the reserves because my family just has always served. And I was in training when they crashed the planes into the towers and the Pentagon. And like everybody else, it just really upset me and made me mad. So I went back on active duty in the military as a surgeon, deployed with the Marines as a first team surgeon, and then eventually found myself back in a world I had left behind when I was recruited to join a East Coast SEAL team to provide some support for that unit, and wound up doing that for the next few years. So my military background is a little bit mixed and eclectic, but it's great for a writer because I've got a lot of points of view that I can write.
Exactly. You bring reality to some of these scenes, especially when people get shot up.
Right.
Stuff like that. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so.
Great. Yeah, no, I don't have quite as diverse a pedigree as Jeff, and it is fantastic what he brings. All the experience that he brings to the team. I just was underwater most of the time when Jeff was running around doing his escapades, I think. But in all seriousness, though, I'm a Navy veteran as well. I was an officer on a fast attack submarine in the Pacific, and did a tour on the USS Louisville. And after that, I went, sort of got the entrepreneurial bug and when got my master's in business and started a company and did that. But on the background, there was always, I always was interested in storytelling and, you know, was working on that first book while I was doing business stuff. And then, met Jeff at a writing conference and we became fast friends. And after that, we started collaborating on Tier 1 and never looked back.
Well, it might not be culturally correct to say, but I think of you as the two amigos, or Lucy and Ethel, whichever you prefer, because you guys are a perfect, perfect team. And what is your website? Where do people find you?
You can find us at andrews-wilson.com, and that's a great source to sign up for our newsletter and get special access, special deals, giveaways and stuff, but also just to see what's going on with all the different series that we've got coming up over the next year or two. It's going to be a very exciting 2 years as we launch all of these new books and new series. But one thing I'll tell our fans, don't worry, Tier 1 will never stop. So Book 7 will be coming out over the next year, even though we have these other books coming as well.
Am I right to predict that might be the China trilogy?
Might be moving somewhere in the Pacific.
Oh, you
possible.
Never know. Okay, well, guys, as always, it's great. I want you to make a date here to come here to the studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida. It is so beautiful. And you will be right here in the studio with me, okay?
Yeah, that's the plan.
Oh, okay, yeah, we have to, and hopefully we're not wearing masks.
That'd be great.
Okay, great. Okay, take care, and everybody, get this book. Get all of the books. Start with Collateral, but then go back and get them all. Thank you both so much for being here on the program today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kathy.
So
always a pleasure.
Okay, bye bye now. Bye.
Bye.
Wow. Aren't they great? They are so nice. They are such a nice, just such nice guys. And the book is exciting. It is exciting. First of all, I love anything to do with Marines, by the way. I love anything to do with pilots. As Big Ed knows, I should have been a general. So this book is really right up my alley. They write about the military stuff so nicely, and I learned so much. There was a lot of stuff I didn't know, some of these things that they write about I didn't know, and I found it so fascinating. So really, those are just fantastic books to get, both of them. We need something to divert our minds from what's going on around us right now. I think it's almost like overloaded with the news, and it's sort of scary to watch all the news, and scary to go without your mask, because again, I ran into Publix. I got right halfway down the store before I realized I didn't have my mask on. Luckily, nobody stopped me. But I shop at 7 in the morning because I cannot stand crowds anyway. So nobody probably was awake. Anyway, people, be kind. And meanwhile, remember, one of the things that I always say is one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky to hear those words, lights, camera, action. And your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or maybe a movie on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. So start writing today. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room because he's so nice, and he sprayed up the whole place with Clorox number 5 just for me. Thank you, Ed. And he saluted me, and I saluted him. And everybody, have a great day. Bye-bye now.